We all know what happened in Czechoslovakia, the moving in of the troops. We know that there were a lot of troops. Nobody knows exactly how many. There's top estimates to the effect that there were more troops than we now have in Vietnam, and perhaps still more. A large body of people from the outside. One of the accompanying Soviet commissars, if I may revive that old term, decided to take a public opinion poll and went around the streets and asking people. The first man he met, he said, "How do you find things?" And the fellow thought for a minute and said, "Well, I'd say about middling." The commissar said, "Middling? What in the world do you mean by middling?" And he said, "Well, they're worse than they were last month, but better than next." We'll now turn to Professor Faltzgraf, who will discuss for us the implications of the Czech invasion on NATO.
In literature on alliance cohesion, it is almost axiomatic that alliances are formed in response to perceived external threat, and by the same token that alliances are dissolved as the danger from outside diminishes. Common to the literature on NATO has been the assertion that in recent years, the threat from the Soviet Union has declined, the threat to Western Europe from the Soviet Union has declined, and that therefore the cohesiveness of the Atlantic Alliance has been reduced. It was the communist coup in Czechoslovakia in March of 1948 which contributed decisively to the formation of the Brussels Pact of that year and subsequently to the Atlantic Alliance. In the light of propositions about the relationship between alliance cohesion and external threat, together with the impact of the 1948 Czech coup upon Western security arrangements, it is appropriate to examine the impact of the Czech crisis of 1968 upon the Atlantic Alliance. In the period before the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, Western perceptions of change in Eastern Europe had important implications both for European integration and for the Atlantic Alliance. The quest for a normalization of relations with communist states competed with the movement toward integration in Western Europe and contributed to the reduction of military commitments to NATO. Although its long-range implications cannot be assessed, the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia had several effects upon the Atlantic Alliance. Its immediate effect was to revive in Western Europe, and especially in the German Federal Republic, the fear that the Soviet Union might be tempted to use military power not only elsewhere in Eastern Europe, but also in Western Europe. Secondly, the crisis cast doubt upon the assumptions which have guided West European governments, as well as the United States, in policies designed to promote both a détente with the Soviet Union and the loosening of communist bloc ties by means of increased trade and political contacts with East European countries. But the Czech crisis had yet another effect. It gave new urgency to a reassessment of the adequacy of NATO force levels, strategic doctrine, and organizational structure, these three areas in particular. As a result of the Czech crisis, there is a newfound consensus among NATO countries that reductions in troop strength, which had been planned before the Czech invasion, before the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, should be abandoned or at least postponed. Within the United States, congressional proponents of large-scale withdrawals of U.S. forces from the German Federal Republic laid aside their proposals for the temporary future at least. Unlike the Berlin crisis of 1961, however, when the United States undertook a major military buildup in Western Europe, the initial response of the Johnson administration was to call for greater European efforts to meet the established NATO conventional force goals as a prerequisite to the strengthening of U.S. military units in Western Europe. The United States made an increased military commitment to NATO, contingent upon action by West European governments to provide a greater contribution to European defense. Perhaps the most complete statement of this position was contained in the address of Undersecretary of State Katzenbach to the Western European Union Assembly on October 16th. Katzenbach called upon West European countries not only to assume a greater share of the burden of defense, but also to achieve, as he put it, a Western European unity of will and purpose to allocate those resources in a more efficient manner, end of quotation. In the Czech crisis, the United States then found yet another opportunity to urge upon Western Europe not only a greater commitment to its defense, but the assumption as well of a greater role in the world beyond Europe. According to Katzenbach, to quote once again, as Europe expands its horizons to encompass more of the world, it will make it easier for the United States, which is pressed from all sides for political, economic, and military assistance, to rethink its priorities in a reasonable and responsible manner. And it will make it easier for us to continue our commitment to Western Europe as our first priority interest, which it is and clearly should remain, end of quote. Militarily, the immediate effect of the Czech crisis was to alter the East-West balance of conventional forces in Europe. Before this crisis, the Warsaw Pact, with approximately 960,000 troops, enjoyed only a slight edge in manpower over NATO, with its approximately 900,000 troops. With the arrival in Czechoslovakia of communist bloc forces, primarily, of course, from the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact troop strength was increased to about 1.3 million. The Soviet Union stationed major military forces on the Czech-West German frontier, thus heightening apprehension within the Federal Republic about both the adequacy of NATO capabilities and the intentions of the Soviet Union. In fact, the efficiency with which the Soviet Union was able to move several hundred thousand troops to battle positions for the occupation of Czechoslovakia reinforced fears about the stability of the military balance in Europe. Although the Soviet invading force consisted of regular army units, the Soviet Union was able quickly to move reserves and home guard units into support positions. If the Soviet performance in Czechoslovakia is indicative, the Soviet Union would be able quickly to deploy major new forces in Central Europe from reserves stationed on Soviet territory, either to halt undesirable changes in other East European countries or to strengthen the Soviet position in the advent of a confrontation with the West over, for example, West Berlin. Indeed, the Czech crisis points up dramatically, I would suggest, the isolation of West Berlin, as well as the severe limitations upon Western power to come to the aid of the former German capital. Official U.S. statements stressed the dangers for NATO inherent in the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia. According to Alan C. Enthoven, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Systems Analysis, and I quote Enthoven here, the sudden aggressiveness displayed by the Soviets in invading Czechoslovakia has introduced the dangerous element of increased unpredictability, end of quote. Mirroring the dismay of a person whose assumptions and expectations about an adversary have been proven wrong by events, Enthoven admitted that, and I quote him again here, it is my conclusion, and of course the position of the United States government, that the Soviet Union has now demonstrated a willingness to use force to interfere in the affairs of another state that many persons had hoped was a relic of the past. I mean, note the total surprise of this man in this case. No wonder we were caught unawares in Washington of what was going on in Eastern Europe. In a speech to the meeting of the North Atlantic Treaty Association in Lisbon on October 15th, General Lemnitzer, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, declared that the net effect of the Soviet invasion was to strengthen the Warsaw Pact, and I agree with him here. He said, the fact is that Soviet forces are today deployed much farther forward. They are in a high state of readiness, and Soviet divisions are now in Czechoslovakia on the borders of NATO, where they have not been since 1945, and they are there in strength. End of quote. The Czech crisis, to come to another point now, has cast further doubt upon the strategic doctrine of flexible response, which NATO adopted in November 1967. This strategy calls for the use, initially at least, of conventional forces in the event of a communist attack in Europe. France, of course, has opposed such a strategy, since allegedly it might tempt the Soviet Union to attack Western Europe, without fear that NATO would respond with nuclear weapons against the Soviet Union. Indeed, French withdrawal from the military organization of the alliance when this took place cast doubt upon the wisdom of a strategy of flexible response, since NATO was deprived then of the defense in depth once afforded by supply depots and bases in France. French opposition, together with the reductions in conventional force levels completed or planned before the Czech crisis, made dubious the credibility of the flexible response strategy. At the same time as we were adopting the flexible response strategy, Warsaw Pact forces were being strengthened and modernized. Again, to quote from General Lemnitzer, as he suggested in his address to the North Atlantic Treaty Association several weeks ago. He said, the facts are that the Warsaw Pact powers comprise the most formidable conventional armed forces in the world today, that they are backed by plentiful tactical air support and nuclear power, that beyond this there exists the powerful strategic nuclear capability that can inflict catastrophic damage on the West. These capabilities are constantly being improved year by year by the introduction of new and modern weapons and equipment. Their defense budgets increase year by year. In short, they, the Warsaw Pact forces, possess a tremendous military capability and potential far beyond that required to defend against the military capabilities of NATO. The stationing in Czechoslovakia of Soviet divisions equipped with nuclear capabilities has reinforced, of course, European concern about the adequacy of prevailing NATO strategic concepts. Reportedly, the NATO Military Committee has now discussed the revision of alliance strategy to provide for the early use of tactical nuclear weapons. In his speech of October 15th, General Lemnitzer declared that as a result of the Soviet action, the Allies, he said, would be forced to commit reserves to include nuclear weapons at an earlier point in the conflict, end of quote. And in the communique issued at the end of the meeting of the NATO Ministerial Council on November 16th, the following passage was in this communique. The conventional capability of NATO's tactical air forces will be increased. Certain additional national forces, national units, will be committed to the major NATO commanders. Specific measures have been approved within these categories of action for improving the conventional capability of NATO's forces, end of quotation. Conceivably, as a result of events in Czechoslovakia, the divergence between US and French strategic concepts concerning the defense of Europe may be narrowed in fact, if not in theory. In addition, the Soviet invasion has led to a reassessment of the adequacy of NATO mechanisms for consultation and decision-making. On August 25th, Chancellor Kiesinger, for example, called for a summit meeting of NATO leaders. Subsequently, the British government proposed the development within NATO of a European caucus or grouping, which would provide a greater European identity, as it was put, within the alliance. Such a grouping, it was suggested, might contribute to greater defense collaboration among principal European powers. and at the same time provide to Western Europe a voice in the alliance less unequal to that of the United States. Beyond the discussion of such proposals, the Czech crisis is likely to contribute to more concerted efforts within the NATO nuclear planning group to provide detailed contingency plans concerning both strategy and the use of nuclear weapons, at least at the tactical level, in alternative contingencies in Europe. Yet another effect of the Czech crisis has been to delay ratification of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Whatever its merits, the treaty in all likelihood would have accelerated those disintegrative tendencies present in NATO on the eve of the Soviet military intervention in Czechoslovakia. Neither the German Federal Republic, France, nor Italy was committed to the treaty. Both French and German leaders, as well as the Italian government, had expressed reservations about the treaty. France, of course, was unwilling to sign the treaty, and both Italy and the Federal Republic had questioned the adequacy of nuclear guarantees for non-nuclear powers, and also the effects of the treaty upon peacetime nuclear development, as well as the absence from the treaty of the so-called European clause, which in earlier versions would have permitted the development of a European nuclear force. By ratifying the treaty, the United States would, of course, have limited severely its ability to contribute to the building of an Atlantic or European nuclear force. Britain, if she signed the treaty as she was prepared to do, would increase the obstacles to her entry into the European community and would diminish the prospects for British participation in a West European defense organization. In the Federal Republic, the treaty had heightened fears about the adequacy of NATO to German security. In all likelihood, the prompt ratification of the treaty would have added weight to the arguments of those in the Federal Republic who call for greater German reliance upon national solutions to defense problems. If the Non-Proliferation Treaty would have strained the Federal Republic's links with NATO, the Soviet Union has, in the period since the Czech invasion, attempted to increase German apprehension about the reliability of Western defense guarantees. On several occasions, the Soviet Union has suggested that Articles 53 and 107 of the United Nations Charter permit Soviet intervention in Germany, quote, against renewal of aggressive policy by a former enemy state, end of quote. The Soviets have repeated their long-held contention that the Federal Republic has not been denazified and that extreme rightist groups are seeking once again to assert themselves. Adopting such logic, however, I would suggest, Western allies might claim, with at least as great justification, the right to intervene in East Germany, where the communist regime, of course, has made considerable use of former Nazi officials in administrative and party positions. Whatever its effect upon NATO, the Soviet campaign against the Federal Republic appears to have been designed to halt West German efforts to establish commercial and political contacts with East European countries and to prevent the spread of, quote, liberalizing, unquote, tendencies to other communist states, including East Germany. Alternatively, the Soviets may have embarked on their latest anti-German campaign in an effort to justify the Czech invasion by reviving fears of revanchism, as they put it, from Germany, a long-standing theme in Soviet propaganda against the Federal Republic. In the absence of large-scale reductions in Soviet troop levels in Czechoslovakia or a major strengthening of NATO, the Warsaw Pact forces will remain quantitatively superior to those of the Atlantic Alliance. In order to counter such increases, the NATO countries, in addition to rescinding decisions to cut back troop levels, might undertake, at the very least, to bring to full strength in manpower the divisions already assigned to NATO. A portion of the British forces scheduled for redeployment in Britain from points east of Suez might be sent instead to the Federal Republic to build up to full strength the British Army of the Rhine. Qualitatively, the strength of NATO forces might be improved by re-equipping them with more modern weapons for conventional warfare and improving their mobility of action. Such measures have been discussed in NATO meetings since the Czech crisis. In summary, NATO members have agreed to the following as a result of the Czech crisis. First of all, improvements in the quality, effectiveness, and deployment of NATO's forces in order to provide a better capability for defense as far forward as possible. In particular, Belgium, which has suspended a planned reduction of her 6th Brigade Army by one-third, will contribute more regular troops. Norway will increase ammunition stocks. The German Federal Republic will allocate more funds for non-commissioned officers, suspend plans to place 9 regular battalions on a training status, provide its armed forces with improved firepower, and strengthen anti-aircraft defenses against low-level attack. Greece will make available 4 new submarines to NATO service in the Mediterranean. Britain will transfer to NATO ships and aircraft from Southeast Asia. Canada has promised to contribute 4 helicopter-equipped destroyers and 2 support ships. The Netherlands will complete the re-equipping of her army. Secondly, the conventional capability of NATO tactical air forces will be increased. Thirdly, increased attention will be given to the problems of NATO's flanks, especially in the Mediterranean. Either in response to European pledges of greater commitments to NATO, or the fear that the military balance was shifting to the Soviet Union, the United States announced on November 14th that U.S. force levels in Europe will be strengthened. First, the United States will return to Germany for maneuvers early in 1969, the 2 brigades of the 24th Infantry Division, totaling about 10,000 men. Secondly, U.S. units in Europe will be equipped with the F-4 Phantom fighter aircraft, which has proven successful in the Vietnam War. Thirdly, the Air Force's Rapid Reaction Force, based in the United States, will be earmarked for use by General Lemnitzer. Fourthly, orders deactivating maritime patrol aircraft in Europe will be suspended, with the aircraft being made available for service in the Mediterranean and other European coastlines, which are a part of NATO. Fifth, shelters for aircraft based in the German Federal Republic and the Netherlands will be constructed. Sixth, the electronic warfare capabilities of U.S. forces in Europe will be expanded. Seventh, the United States will step up efforts to improve the combat readiness of the Army's strategic reserve of active duty forces in the United States, 3 divisions of which have been earmarked for service in Europe. Aside from such planned changes, thus far the principal effect, I would emphasize, of the Czech crisis has been to slow the impetus toward further reductions in NATO force levels. In the absence of the Czech crisis, moreover, one or more NATO countries might have exercised the option under Article 13 to give 1 year's notice of termination of their membership when the treaty reaches its 20th anniversary in April 1969, regarding France. It said even the foreign minister of France recalled that, for its part, unless events in the years to come were to bring about a radical change in East-West relations, the French government considers that the alliance must continue as long as it appears to be necessary, end of quote. Yet I would suggest it is problematical as to whether the Czech crisis will speed the development of policies designed in the longer run to strengthen the alliance, even though the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia provides a new rationale for the preservation and strengthening of NATO. If the Soviet leadership faces challenges to communist bloc unity elsewhere in Europe, I would suggest, it may be tempted, of course, to intervene militarily elsewhere. In apparent response to such a fear, Secretary of State Rusk declared in his speech to the NATO Council on November 15th that the alliance must be prepared to deter further action by the Soviet Union against countries such as Austria, Finland, Romania, and Yugoslavia. NATO provides a framework, I would suggest, not only for the development of a common Western defense, but for the coordination of Western policies in response to Soviet policy in Eastern Europe. Recent events have provided the United States with unique opportunities for a reassessment of relationships with our West European allies. It was, as I suggested, the Czech communist coup of 1948 which led to the development of the Brussels Pact and ultimately to the formation of NATO. The latest Czech crisis has given new urgency to a reassessment of NATO at a time when NATO approaches its 20th anniversary, and with the coming into office of a new administration in Washington, the United States is engaged, of course, in a reappraisal of its foreign policy goals and priorities for the 1970s. In such a reassessment, the United States, as well as its NATO allies, should distinguish between Western conceptions of détente and Soviet conceptions of peaceful coexistence. Within the West, there has been the marked tendency in recent years to press for détente with the Soviet Union under the assumption that greater unilateral and multilateral contacts with the communist world would reduce ideological, social, and political differences and lead eventually to political settlements. Policymakers and non-governmental elites in both the United States and Western Europe have expressed surprise and shock that the Soviets have not reciprocated such overtures. While Western proponents of détente have striven for a peaceful world based upon security and far-ranging East-West contacts, the Soviets have pursued a policy of peaceful coexistence aimed toward limited agreements but embodying permanent competition by means short of war. As Manlio Brosio, Secretary General of NATO, suggested in the aftermath of the Czech crisis, and I quote him here, "In not accepting détente, the clear intent of the communist camp thereby is to hold their grip on their internal regimes and to weaken, divide, and infiltrate the social systems of the non-communist countries. The differences between the two policies, peaceful coexistence and détente, are very real and appeared in all their clarity in the Czechoslovak episode, in which the internal changes in the Czechoslovak regime, due, of course, to spontaneous sources, but encouraged and promoted by the example and comparison coming from intensified Western contacts, threatened to carry the Czech people from the stage of peaceful coexistence to the stage of real détente. It was for that reason brutally stopped by the leading communist country," end of quote. Brosio is undoubtedly correct in his contention that contact with the West has at least contributed to unrest in communist countries. If policies of détente have led to such contact, and hence to unrest and Soviet repression, the West has much to gain from increased interaction with the peoples of Eastern Europe. But because of likely Soviet reactions, the pursuit of such policies by the West is fraught with considerable risk, especially if policies of détente are accompanied by reductions in the strength of Western security arrangements. In short, I would suggest in concluding, the sine qua non for Western policies of détente in Europe is an effective security arrangement for the North Atlantic area if the West is not to tempt the Soviets not only to react forcefully in Eastern Europe, but also conceivably to take action against the West, the perceived source, from the Soviet standpoint, of much of East European restlessness. Thank you.